This morning, I'd like to address three issues that were raised in the brief, but I'd like to go in the following order. I'd like to begin with the Eamon issue, the witness Thomas Dewey, and his testimony about the vanishing or phantom Eamon from Michael Weil. Second, I'd like to discuss the excited utterance statement made to the jogger, Mr. Bigelow, encountered on the road the morning after the shooting. And third, if we have time, I'd like to address the prior consistent statements, which we contend were used to bolster the in-court testimony of Mr. Bigelow and the witness, Mr. Lopez Paz. The Dewey email was a critical piece of evidence with regard to the element of premeditation in the sixth count against Mr. Weil.
Wasn't that critical?
Excuse me?
Wasn't that critical?
That's what the government said when they made their arguments in the district courts.
We're looking at it now.
I understand.
And so I'm just curious because there's some interesting arguments presented here with respect to the email, but ultimately you'd have to show prejudice. And it seems like the case here against your client, especially in light of the surviving folks and the eyewitness testimony, that seems like a pretty high bar for you to meet. So I wonder if we could work backwards.
Sure. There was plenty of evidence of the shooting. There was plenty of evidence regarding the marijuana grow. But the question of whether the shooting was actually premeditated, that is, whether he fought in advance, was not as clear. And the self-defense defense was put up by the defendant. The defendant testified. The government, in its closing argument, suggested 12 factors that it claimed showed premeditation. But most of those were just recitations of the facts surrounding the grow.
Well, let me tell you what I'm focused on, because we have the eyewitness testimony from Bigelow and Lopez Paz. Mr. Wilde admitted that he took guns and cell phones from all three men. Mr. Wilde admitted that he arrived armed and without cash to pay the men. Juarez Woodard was shot in the back in pursuit. Mr. Wilde did not call the police after the incident. Mr. Wilde disposed of the weapon and the cell phone after the incident, and then he texted his girlfriend to say stop the logs the day of the incident. It just seems that that is, even if you take out the email, considerable, if not overwhelming, evidence of premeditation, as well as evidence of other elements surrounding first-degree murder.
Well, I don't believe it is overwhelming at all, because what you have is you have this scenario that's starting a couple of days before the actual shooting, where things are starting to disintegrate, and the two workers are concerned about whether they're going to get paid. They're mad about having to work out in the sun. They want to leave. Wilde testifies that he feels that he's seeing a side of these guys that he's never seen before, and he's concerned about what's going on. So he's concerned about the fact that they've got guns, that they've got these sort of wild backgrounds, he decides to take the guns away. That's certainly consistent with trying to protect himself in terms of what's happening in this disintegrating situation.
Was there some testimony that he then gave more than back the gun? In other words, what is his self-defense story exactly? How did these people without guns endanger him? Or did one of them now have a gun?
Well, he thought they had a gun.
He thought they had a different gun.
That's right. Or he got, I mean, he testified that he testified at one point that his his gun had been stolen from his house, and he was going into a, let's call it, sort of paranoid, somewhat delusional state.
This is what I don't understand. Rule 100A seems to have a specific exception for this situation. In a jury trial, the jury determines in accordance with Rule 104B any issue about whether an asserted writing, recording, or photograph ever existed, another one produced at the trial or hearing is the original, or other evidence of content accurately reflects its content. So this rule seems to be saying that this sort of thing that you're concerned about does go to the jury.
Correct.
Right? So the gatekeeping operation appears to be just an ordinary gatekeeping operation, i.e., could any rational juror find this? I mean, you at points seem to be arguing for something stricter, and then in your reply brief, you were arguing that we have contradictory case law. There does seem to be a statement in a recent Second Circuit case, but it just seems flat wrong given this rule.
Well,
that's what the rule seems to say, that the jury, it is for the jury.
Well, let me answer it in two ways. One, the Holliston case, which is the principal case, you could a rational jury accept the plea of evidence. The Holliston case says, could a rational jury find by preponderance of the evidence? That, no, Holliston doesn't say the court has to find preponderance of the evidence. The court says, Holliston says the court has to ask whether a rational jury could find by preponderance of the evidence, and the district court never made that determination. District court basically said, I don't know, it's not a credible scenario, and then he said it could go either way. The district judge never said.
Isn't it fair to assume it was building in the right standard? And then you also argue for an instruction, but it strikes me that this is what juries do. If they don't believe that their story is so, if they don't believe that there ever was a writing, then they're not going to rely on it, so it takes care of itself.
Well, the Rule 1008 says it's for the jury to determine, and I would focus on that word, determine. The jury here never made a determination. It didn't do anything. It just received the evidence.
Because it either believed the story or it didn't believe the story. And with regard to the harmlessness, it seems to me that the likelihood that it didn't believe that has such weak evidence that that's another reason that it was likely harmless. But even given the, assuming that they considered it, they still had to consider whether, in fact, it existed or it didn't exist. It seems they had to do that. It was argued to them that it didn't exist, and they had to decide whether it did or didn't exist.
Are we looking at the instruction under plain error review?
Excuse me?
Are we not looking at the instruction?
Yes.
So you're saying it was plain error?
Yeah, I'm saying it's plain error because Rule 108 says a determination has to be made. The jury had no way of telling what to do with this evidence. I mean, the evidence comes in. It's very weak. It's all over the board. The evidence is that Chewie destroyed the email. No, he didn't destroy it. Lyle destroyed it. Somebody else may have destroyed it. The bookkeeper may have destroyed it. And nobody knows what the story is, but no determinations are made.
But the evidence comes in as any other evidence comes in, i.e., somebody is saying it, and the other side is arguing that this is not believable, and then you either believe it or you don't believe it. And so I don't understand what would be added by an instruction that says you can either believe it or not believe it.
Well, it's like any other piece of conditional evidence where the court instructs the jury, what do you do with, how do you process this particular evidence? Do you just get an instruction that says here are the elements of the crime, where the elements of the crime met beyond a reasonable doubt, or does the judge tell the jury, with respect to this email, it is your job to determine by preponderance of the evidence whether it exists, and if so, then you can consider it. My said, it's not like any other evidence that comes into court because you don't want
to
wait.
The possible difference, I guess, is that I suppose you want to move on to the excited utterance, but I suppose one difference is that this may suggest that the jury has to be unanimous as to the preponderance. In other words, it can't be that each individual juror goes and does what he wants with his evidence. Is that the difference? There would have to be a determination by the jury as a separate unanimous decision as to whether there's been proof of preponderance of the evidence.
No, I think the instruction says, in order for you to consider this evidence, you, juror, have to decide that this exists by preponderance of the evidence, and then you decide whether there is a reasonable doubt as to the elements of the crime.
What about the excited utterance?
So you're claiming basically that this fades in choice the jury properly, that the preponderance of the evidence is the standard that they have to consider in respect to whether they should consider that particular evidence. Is it failure to instruct is what you're talking about?
That's right.
And really, we take the instructions as a whole. You know, I'm thinking about the fact that we have voluntary issues all the time, so the jury is also being a gatekeeping function every hearing, and then the jury is sentencing. You know, consider that as well. I mean, it's part of the jury's deliberations. How is that different than the situation?
Well, the difference is you've got a federal rule of evidence, 1008, which puts an extra layer on this, you know, general admissibility question, and that's why, to go back to Judge Berzon, and to answer your question, Judge Blum, is that it's not just a question of admissibility. It's because you look at admissibility first under rules of the 400 series, and then, as Huddleston and as the Evans case says, you look to, is there another rule that controls admissibility? And here there is. It's called the best evidence rule, and it's in rules 1004 and 1008. I'm going to run out of time,
so. So I would like to hear a little bit about the excited utterance.
Okay. With respect to the excited utterance, it's not just a statement that he did, or here's how it happened. It's a statement that occurs approximately 12 hours after the fact. Clearly, Mr. Bigelow is excited. He's, in fact, terrified. With regard to the shooting that he's witnessed, but he's had a lot of time to think about it. In fact, he's had an entire evening to think about it. And what he ends up telling Mr. Graham, the jogger on the road, takes up about a page and a half of transcript, and it's a narrative. It's a narrative of what happened. The question is, can you cross-examine a narrative? You can't cross-examine a narrative, and that's what this is. And so there's two bases for excluding this statement. And the reason this statement is important, to go directly to the prejudice question, is because Bigelow wasn't the greatest witness. I mean, he was a witness. He was the first witness. And he really had to be bolstered. So they used Graham as the second witness, the jogger, to, by means of this narrative, have him repeat the story through Graham. And the defense counsel could cross-examine Graham as to the accuracy of what he heard.
The question I have is that I understand the time delay problem, which seems to me to be probably longer than any instance. I mean, is there any case in which an excited utterance was admitted this long after the fact? I guess they're claiming that he was still excited because
he was still excited.
But the other question is the narrative, as you're emphasizing. I mean, usually an excited utterance is, in other words, it's not a story. Is there any law on that at all? I mean, any comparators or anything that's like this that was
considered? I couldn't find anything. The closest thing I could find in anywhere in the footnote in my brief, there are a couple of cases that deal with children where, the time gap is a little bit longer. But ordinarily, I mean, this court has cases where they've found it wasn't an excited utterance when an hour went by and a person told the story to someone else in the interim year.
The utterance is something used for something like, oh, he killed me, or he killed him, or something. It's not my law. wrong story.
That's right. I mean, here he's retelling the whole thing in capsule form, to be sure. And he's excited, but, I mean, I know a lot of people that are really excitable and really excited.
And he'll go running off like a wild pig up the tree when he sees a car. I mean, this is pretty distinct. I mean, in a unique set of circumstances because of the ongoing nature, was it not? I mean, of his fear.
I'm not doubting his fear. We're not doubting his fear. But the fact is that there was such a long interval. I mean, the question is whether it
was. Was there really a long interval when that was ongoing? I mean, up to the moment that he saw the jogger, including while he's talking to the jogger, it seems like he's still very afraid and recounting everything that has happened. It's literally spilling it out. And so I just think that, you know, it seems a bit of a challenge for you, even though normally I understand what your argument is, but this situation, I think, is pretty distinctive.
If we accept that, any time a person is suffering from PTSD,
no.
Then no.
I don't think so, because it seems like he was still trying to run away or be away from the defendant appellant here.
Well, then it's going to come in all sorts of cases. It's going to come in kidnapping cases. It's going to come in accident cases. Any case where there's a big gap in time and somebody's very excitable for good reasons, it's going to eat up the exception to the hearsay rule.
Is there a lot of fact to see the time element in the temporal aspects, climbing up a tree, not climbing up a tree, staying in the woods all night, and the district court had all of these facts to consider and made a determination once a state did a review as the appellate court?
Well, with regard to the interpretation of the hearsay exception, it's de novo. It's a question of law, but if the district court made the correct determination, then it's abuse of discretion.
Well, I think it's an abuse of discretion standard here under the circumstances of this case, is it not?
Under the circumstances of this case, no, because this exception to the hearsay rule is being stretched way out there.
Well, you say that it's so strange that it would be an abuse of discretion as a matter of law to make this determination.
Is there?
Okay, here's your next step. I'll give you a minute to rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Meredith Osborne of the United States. During Wilde's 16-day trial, Wilde admitted that he shot and killed Roberto Juarez Madrid, an undocumented worker that he'd hired to tend his marijuana grow after Juarez Madrid asked to be paid.
Let's start with the excited utterance.
Sure.
Why won't this swallow up the excited utterance rule?
Judge Murguia, this is a unique situation because, as you pointed out, it's not merely that he was still excited, which Mr. Schwartz concedes, but it was that the event was still ongoing. This is analogous to
the event that he talked about.
Well, yes, Your Honor, because he was talking about the fact that he was being hunted down by Wilde.
I said the whole thing. And that, so it was being excited unto an utterance, which could be introduced. But here, what strikes me as unique about the situation is that he is telling an extensive story about something that happened 12 hours before that was the reason that led to his current situation, but it's not his current situation. And I don't know of any analog to that. I mean, ordinarily, and my recollection, and I haven't gone back and looked at it, is that the excited utterance exception is basically, in common law, an extension of the present sense impression. And that it has always been understood to be pretty limited to something that is the whole notion being that you didn't have time to think about it, and it's so spontaneous that it must be accurate. And in here, I mean, whatever else is the case, he had 12 hours to think about it, and what he's recounting is not his current circumstances.
No. In fact, he is saying saying that he, that his first statement to Graham is, they're trying to kill me. That is a present sense.
Okay, and I think that maybe there's some part of this that is an excited utterance, but the whole tale about, you know, how he came to be working there and the guns and so on was not an excited utterance.
Let me make an analogy to a kidnapping victim. Let's say that J.C. Dugard, for instance, is the first person that she sees when she manages to escape from her captivity. And she says, I was kidnapped 10 years ago, and I've been held in captivity ever since. This is exactly the same sort of situation. This is the very first person that Bigelow is encountering during a 12-hour ordeal. In fact, his ordeal didn't end until after he spoke to Graham, and Graham returned with the agents and told Bigelow, these are law enforcement. You're safe. You can come out of the woods now. That's when the startling event ends. Up until then, the startling event, just like the period of captivity, and I agree that there is not a case directly on point in the circuit about this, but that is because this is a unique situation. But it's not a slippery slope such that in any case, 12 hours later, after somebody was held up, for instance.
That's unique, not conceptually unique, is what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And in fact, if this court were to hold the opposite, that this was not an excited utterance, then someone like the kidnapping victim would never be able to say, I was kidnapped 16 years earlier and I'm just going to get out
of testify. But that's not what this is about. This is about whether this statement, out-of-court statement to someone else can come in.
I would also say that this testimony was not a long story. It covered about 2 pages of testimony. It was several lines over the course of a 16-day trial. So, again, I think this was already pointed out by Judge Block, but the standard is an abuse of discretion. And in addition, Bigelow testified to all of this himself. So there's no larger concern about him not being cross-examined about it. And then, as you pointed out, Judge Berzon, some of it would probably come in under the present sense impression. So that even narrows down the amount of testimony that we're talking about further to simply several lines. So this was not a 20-minute-long conversation that he was recounting here. This was a quick, help, get me help. I'm being hunted down. I've been hunted down all night. I'm not coming out until I see you with a police officer coming to get me assistance. He says that at ER 14. So this is a very short statement that he's making.
Can you talk a little bit about the prior consistent statements? This is what I quite understand. The fact that he was, I understand your basic argument to be that by pointing out that he had, that these people had immunity, that they were challenging their credibility, and the question is whether or not that was a recent, when he was accusing her of a recent fabrication. Is that basically right?
Yes, I mean, I think there's two reasons that this came in. The first being that they were both cross-examined about the immunity that he was given to testify in the state court preliminary hearing, and Lopez Paz about the U visa application that the government made on his behalf. And then also because Bigelow was cross-examined extensively using his prior consistent statements, the statements that he made both on the day after the shooting and, yes,
it seems fairly straightforward, but as to the other, they're getting immunity because I have a hard time linking up the immunity with an accusation of fabrication. In other words, they're getting the immunity in order so that they will testify rather than not testifying. get the immunity.
Well, this is the paradigmatic case of, you know, I mean, the granting of immunity is, almost every case in which I've seen that it's come up is being used to raise the implication that the witness is testifying on the government's behalf. And that's what this court has said.
But the immunity itself is not the time when any fabrication would have occurred. That's the only point I'm trying to make. You're trying to figure out when, at what point, the notion. In other words, in this instance, the claim is that, well, they had reasons to lie from the beginning. And the same reason they had to lie from the beginning is the same reason that they would have lied to get the immunity. But it's not the immunity that's the lie.
I think I understand your question to be about the claim that because they lied, maybe, yes, Your Honor. But if we were to go back and say that they had an incentive to lie from the moment that they encountered law enforcement immediately after the shooting, because that's when the statements right after the shooting were given, that would be contrary to this court's cases that we cited in Bao and Colico, which says that there has to be some law enforcement action, that not just a mere hypothetical concern about.
Is it your position that whenever somebody's granted immunity, that opens the door to allow private citizens to be placed in evidence?
Only if they're questioned about that. Only if they're cross-examined about that at trial.
Well, they're always questioned about the fact that they were granted immunity, right? And I assume that the questioning is as a result of that. You're telling the truth or you're not telling the truth. It's that whole type of questioning that happens just in any case where there's a granted immunity. And your position is that once there's any questioning of that nature at all, it opens the door to trying to assist the statements being the truth or something like this. I just want to get clarification as to what your position is.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that that's what this court said in U.S. v. Allen.
You say Allen is the precedent that says that just questioning somebody about the grant of immunity, you want to slide and look at the door to trying to assist the statements being placed in evidence. You say Allen stands for that proposition.
Yes, I mean, in Allen, this court said this is the classic situation in which evidence of a prior consistent statement is allowed into evidence.
Does the fact that there's any question at all pose the witness that you testify onto a grant of immunity is sufficient to allow that? What do you need more than that?
Yes, and, Your Honor, yes, and here there was more. But yes, that is an implication that the rule itself says that any express or implied motive to fabricate, and so the grant of immunity is an implication by the defense that the witness has been granted something by the government.
Just the fact that it was brought out at the trial that he's testifying under a grant of immunity, your position would be that that would allow you to try to sustain the DNA evidence. I just want to get
Yes, Your Honor, but this court does not need to make such a broad finding here because there was extensive cross-examination.
Yes, the answer is, but in any event, you say there's more here than just questioning about the fact that you're testifying under a grant of immunity. What else was there?
Well, with Lopez Paz, Wilde impeached, and that's the statement that came in at the state preliminary hearing. Wilde impeached Lopez Paz with the government's application for a U visa and. Oh, well, in Bigelow's case, he was extensively impeached with the statements themselves based on consistency. So, you know, this court doesn't even need to decide whether or not those statements properly came in. Oh, no, Your Honor, what I was saying that he was cross-examined with the statements themselves. They were actually introduced by the defendant on pieces of them, but then they were heavily redacted by the district court. So the district court didn't just blanket introduce all the statement. And if this court goes back and looks at those statements, those are in ER 845 and 847, they are heavily redacted by the district court to focus on the testimony that he was impeached with.
Immunity in that context is irrelevant, so you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. You're saying that you had the actual statements that the defense attorneys were introducing on top, or in addition, there was a reference to the immunity grant?
Both, yes, Your Honor. So these came in under both of the exceptions here.
And then with Lopez Paz, is it immunity and a U visa, or just the U visa that they were challenging?
It was just the U visa and the paying for his room and board as well. I see I'm almost out of time.
Yes, please. Do you think that the judge should, as a matter of law, instruct the jury that they have to make that finding in terms of the misuse of the email by a preponderance of the evidence that was not done here? Do you think that the judge should have done that as required?
No, Your Honor, but I would also point out, and thank you, because I wanted to make sure to point out that the district court did give jury instruction number 11, which is about statements of the defendant. And
But the judge definitely, let's get it wrong, did say that the standard is preponderance of the evidence, and there's no charge of impeachment.
No, but the district court said, you have heard the testimony that the defendant made a statement. It is for you to decide, A, one, whether or not the defendant made the statement, and two, if so, how much weight to give it. And so, although that doesn't say the magic words preponderance of the evidence, the district court did instruct the jury on how to consider statements made by the defendant, and there were numerous. This was not the only admission that was testified to during the trial.
Any difference, although Mr. Schwartz does not argue that what OOA actually says, but in a jury trial, the jury determines any issue about. Does that mean that the jury as a whole has to separately decide that by preponderance of the evidence rather than having each juror take it into account while they're voting? Because presumably at that point you could have different jurors coming to different conclusions, some of whom rely on this and others of whom don't rely on this but rely on something else.
I was thinking about that when you asked Mr. Schwartz about that, and it occurred to me that this court has never, certainly can be plain error because this court
says,
yes, that the jury has to
determine something. It usually means as jurors.
But then a special verdict form would be required every time that the best evidence rule was applied. I don't think that there's any precedent for that in this court.
Personally, if I were citing a threat out of this, that's what I would say because that's what it says.
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that that's what that means. The jury determines this just like any other fact, and there are lots of facts in a jury trial that the jury need not decide. For instance, predicates to certain offenses, the jury may not agree about what gun was possessed by a convicted felon, and yet they can agree to convict somebody of being a felon in possession of a firearm. So, requiring jury unanimity as to this particular thing, I think, would be inconsistent with this court's other case law.
But there would sort of be no purpose for the sentence because as I was initially saying, usually if evidence comes in, the jurors say, I believe that guy, I don't believe that guy, I don't think this ever happened. And then they come to a joint conclusion. This seems to be saying there's something special about this.
I disagree. I don't read the rule the same way.
What application does the rule have?
Just the same application that this court has said in Huddleston and Evans, and that the district court applied, that a reasonable jury could decide that the email containing the statement existed. And I just wanted to.
That's true, but anyway.
I see
a reasonable jury could decide it, but the question is, did the jury decide it, or did just some people decide it and other people not decide it? That's the difference. Anyway, go ahead.
I see I'm not a
reasonable juror and a reasonable jury.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I disagree that there's been any requirement ever that such a special verdict be required for a predicate fact, whether under Rule 104 A&B or under Rule 100 A. And I would just point the court to the district court's finding at ER 3 and 661 where it applies the correct standard under Huddleston, contrary to what Mr. Schwartz said in his argument. If there are no further questions, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you. are no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm.
I did have one question. Why did it take so long to bring this case forward?
I admit that I'm not sure that I know exactly why. But this was a case that was adopted from the local authorities, and this is a murder case, so it is necessarily a.
He was arrested in 2010, not died until March of 2012, and then ultimately convicted and sentenced in spring of 2015.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay, thank you very much. You're out of time. Mr. Schwartz, we'll get your opinion.
Thank you. I want to go to the prejudice from the excited utterance from Mr. Bigelow and the prior consistent statement of Mr. Bigelow. Both of these evidentiary issues go to the same witness. And this witness was Bigelow, who was the only eyewitness, in addition to Lopez Paz, who was the fellow who was shot. It's, again, this is critical testimony. This was the first, he was the first witness for the government in Shaky. And he was the last witness for the government. And the reason I say he was the last witness, the last words that the government heard before the jury, that the jury heard before it started to deliberate, were an assistant U.S. attorney reading the prior statement that Mr. Bigelow had given at the time. Then he went to the fire station. So the fact that this evidence came in as both an excited utterance and as a prior consistent statement really bolstered this key witness and really bolstered the prosecution's testimony against Mr. Wilde. And that goes to all of the counts, with the exception of one and two, which are the marijuana distribution and conspiracy counts. I wish I could